Achan, before I ask this question, can we divide the Buddhists into two groups first? One group is those who practice meditation more, and the other group is they don't practice meditation at all, maybe just doing chanting or dana. And there were arguments in order to reach Nibbana faster, one has to meditate. But the other group doesn't agree, but what's your opinion of Achan?
Are you referring more to that Pure Land practice? Is that what you're referring to? Are you referring to
Nibbana.
which one?
To
To
go
go
to
to Nibbana,
Nibbana.
okay, not to go to a Pure Land.
Almost the same, I think.
No, not the same. Well, I think even in Thailand, there's a lot of people that think if they chant a lot and be generous, that they don't need to practice. All I would say is, if you look at this lineage of Lumpur Mun, that to my understanding, it was Lumpur Mun who regenerated the practice tradition in Thailand to a large extent. He had many Arahant disciples, we believe. We have faith. Now, then, if you look at the teachings of those contemporary realized master, and they're all saying, meditate. And they're all saying, merit comes from dana, merit comes from sila, it's your foundation. Foundation for what? Foundation for meditating. And within that meditation, developing insight. So, and certainly Ajahn Chah revolutionized certain things. I wouldn't say revolutionized, he regenerated. He regenerated things that the Buddha established. So, what the Buddha established for lay people of the day in India was that they come and listen to teachings and practice meditation once a week on the lunar observance day. So, what Ajahn Chah did during his time, recognizing that people had the faith but they didn't know how to do it, was that he would have lay people come and spend all day and all night once a week in the monastery, and then there would be a morning chanting and a morning Dhamma talk, and then those lay people walk and sit all day, and then another talk and another chanting session, and then many of them meditate all night alongside with the monks. So here we have Ajahn Chah's example. What did Ajahn Chah do? Ajahn Chah developed infrastructure in the monastery to help those lay people leave their homes and come and practice for a day and a night in the monastery once a week. So I think that makes a pretty serious statement about how valuable and central and important meditation is. And the understanding that they have duties, they have obligations. So what he did was, if you kept that observance once a week, by the end of the year, you've been in meditation retreat for 52 days. You see, and you've listened to 104 Dhamma talks. So this was, this is what. And then in all of Ajahn Chah's branch monasteries, I tried to keep that as a standard for some time. That on that day, people hear Dhamma reflection, they have a chance to chant, then to sit, and sitting together with the monks. And then those lay people in those areas are very fortunate, obviously, and they find that very helpful when you see this row of monks all kind of sitting, and in a sense of, oh, okay, sit. You have examples, you have support, you have moral support. That's very helpful. But this is also their good karma, that they were born in that situation where they could do that. But as far as I could see, also Thanajananan, my main teacher in Thailand, he has the first weekend of the month as a weekend retreat, where so he's opening up that possibility, as well as, people can come and stay whenever they want to. But he has the first weekend where there's Dhamma talks, chanting, sitting, walking for 2 days. So that, again, if you do it 12 months, you've got nearly a month of practice at the end of the year. So, in the Buddha's time, there were some people who attained liberation by listening to Dhamma. There were some people who attained liberation by reflecting while doing other activities. The Buddha does say that one of the wonderful qualities of the Dhamma is that it deepens, practice deepens slowly like an ocean. And so, what you can deduce from that is that all of those people practiced a lot in the past, because of their past practice, their faculties were ripe. Because of the ripeness of their faculties, when hearing the Dhamma, they attained. It's also probably the case that many, many people wanted to be enlightened in the time of the Buddha. They probably made vows. So some of those people could have been enlightened before, but wanted to see a Buddha, wanted to meet a Buddha, and had made a vow, may I become enlightened at the time of the Buddha. So anyone who attained liberation quickly, without much practice, had done a lot already in the past. I think it is possible if one practices really enormous amounts of dana. We could have the example of Visakha, who offered bathing cloths and offered gruel for sick, you know, an enormous amount of merit that she was making. And so this is one way to make the mind bright. But it was dependent upon knowing hundreds of arahants. So she had that incredible field of merit where she was able to make merit with beings who were really pure and really profound, and that merit. The insight is still into impermanence. It doesn't come about just from... There has to be some kind of contemplation occurring. There has to be an insight occurring for the mind to be liberated. So that's the point of insight, and dana can really support it. But most of us don't have the opportunity to make that kind of dana. And as far as I'm aware, the arahants in Thailand of this last century and of this century are encouraging people to practice every day, if they can, and to do retreats as well. So for those who don't practice, it's like, well, start. Why not? You're intelligent. And it's like, Malaysians are disciplined, reflective, educated. All the things that you can do, why can't you meditate? Turn the TV off. Don't spend so much time on the internet. I'm going to start scolding now. Because this is what you need to hear. Why? I don't have time to meditate. Why? Because I was surfing on the net till midnight. Really? Turn it off. Time to use our opportunity. The best time to meditate is in the morning after having rested, before things get busy. And leave a phone in another room on silent, really, because it pulls you out. And meditate in the morning. Just start with 10 minutes a day. If you start with 10 minutes a day, but you have to start with this attitude of being determined not to miss it, not even for a day. But just commit to 10. Everybody can do 10, no matter how busy you are. And then once you've established it as a habit, increase it to 15. Okay? And then once you're doing a 15, increase it to 20. I was telling the people who did my retreat last week that I want them doing an hour in the morning, an hour in the afternoon, an hour in the evening before they die. And you're all laughing. I was serious. Because the thing is, if we recognize our opportunity, we recognize it, and you realize that you're really fortunate to have met these teachings. These teachings can liberate you. And not just that, as this lady was drawing our attention to, this Buddhist sasana is degenerating. The world isn't going to produce as many arahants as it did. You can't assume if you get reborn on this planet that you're going to have the opportunity to practice again. That's not a reasonable assumption. So you have to take the opportunity that you have now. Please start with 10 minutes a day. No, whenever you can fit it in. But the thing about making it a set time is that, you know, if you can make it part of your schedule, you're more likely not to miss it. The value about doing it in the morning is the mind isn't busy yet and it's rested. So if you do it last thing at night, you might be a lot of that, which doesn't produce much clarity. And if you do it in the middle of the day, you'll be thinking about your lunch appointment and what your kid said that was hurtful and whatever, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Pure Land, to me, I don't know whether I'm right or wrong, I think Pure Land is different from the Vajrayana. Is this true?
Yeah, it's understood that beings will attain Nibbana in the Pure Land. That's the belief. So it's one goes to the, if I understand it correctly, one goes to the Pure Land in order to continue to practice and then be liberated from the Pure Land. That's at least the theory. And the theory reflects the path as we understand it as well, that it's your own insight that has to liberate you wherever you are. And if you have the potential now, you know, why try to put it off? And also, I believe in the heaven realms, and I think it is possible to get liberated from a heaven realm. You have an example of the Buddha teaching devas, so it's possible. I don't want to get dismissive of the Pure Land school, because there's things that we don't know. Maybe it's possible. But if one is a Pure Land practitioner, I would assume if you're hoping, let's use the word hope, that your Pure Land practice is going to get you to a very beautiful heavenly realm where you can practice, your Pure Land practice would have to be very sincere. I don't think you could do that practice very half-heartedly, a few oranges and a glass of water, and I don't think that would get you there myself. But if one very diligently did the mantra all day or most of the day, day after day after day, that might. So I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to say there's nothing to that. But in what he asked the question of, you know, the contemporary realized masters are encouraging people to practice and even allowing them, opening up their own monasteries to bring them into practice. So I think that says what we need to be doing. So, I think we can understand it as Tushita. We can understand it as Tushita. That might be helpful if you've studied our cosmology, Realm of the Four Kings, Dawat Himsa, the Yama Devas, and then the Tushita Heaven. And we understand that Maitreya, our future Buddha, is already in Tushita Heaven. So we can understand that. We can understand that. There might be realms where one can practice, where it's conducive, but I think one would need an enormous amount of good karma to be born in Tushita. And so better to practice now with what we have. And it's taking a gamble, isn't it? How do you know? The Buddha said in the suttas, at the time of death, we don't know where we're going to be reborn, even if we've made a lot of good karma. He said it's like throwing a stick up. And he said, we've all made bad karma, and we've all made good karma, and you don't know which one's going to ripen at that moment. So maybe you get to go to the Pure Land, and maybe you don't. You know, as human beings who are intelligent and who are reflective and who have demonstrated that they're capable of disciplining themselves in really remarkable ways, it's perfectly possible to meditate. It's simply a matter of focus and priority, setting a priority.
Thank you, Ajahn, for sharing the Dharma with us this evening. Since you are a Buddhist and trained in the Thai tradition, Theravada, my mind is very disturbed because Thailand is supposed to be a Theravada Buddhist country. Yeah. It should set a very good example. Instead, why is it that Thailand has got this sex image in tourism, especially when we talk about tourism? The first thing in the mind of a tourist is that it is a sex country, a sex city, Bangkok, which I think it is contradictory. So despite the fact that you have so many good teachers and practitioners in the Theravada tradition, they're supposed to be observing the precepts, and yet that come to the lay people, they are not following what the teachers have taught them. Okay. What's the problem?
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Hello. Okay, so I think the same problem exists in Thailand as exists in most places, since we have kind of sort of democracies. At least you have elected elected leaders. I think a lot of really genuinely spiritual people don't want to be politicians, and a lot of greedy, power-hungry people do. And so the kind of person one has running to be an elected leader is not a very inspiring one. And so in Thailand you have this situation where leaders, certain parties, because you have a large rural poor, this is very real in Thailand, rural poor is most of the population, so votes are bought, you see. And so your average villager in Thailand will vote for the politician who paid the most. Now the politician who paid the most, then as soon as he gets elected, has to go and get that money back from the from the public coffer. So you have a corrupted system where and the really really good people, even if they do want to lead their country, they don't have that kind of money to buy votes. So this is a very real phenomena. Another thing to keep in mind is the Buddha did say that this age is the degenerate age. And he said that this is the way that it will be during this age. So although good people have a sense that it could be so much better and it's a shame that it's like this, Lord Buddha said that as the dark age deepens in darkness, the only thing that will count eventually is money. Leaders will be corrupt. The world will be overpowered with obscure views. So basically leaders won't have right view, that their leadership won't be able to last because it won't be very long before somebody just as corrupt and greedy topples a leader. So we're living in an age where leaders aren't very good. Now this is linked, unfortunately, with the fact that most human beings don't keep five precepts now. So we can stand back as one individual and say it shouldn't be like this. But basically, as a race, we get the leaders that we deserve. If the human beings aren't genuinely human, they can't have deva leaders, you see. And if most human beings are functioning on a level which is animal, their leaders are going to be like that. In terms of prostitution in Thailand, it's very complex, and it's like, it's funny as a celibate monk to be saying this, it's like, but just to give an example, it is not uncommon for the woman who prostitutes herself to be putting her brother through university and paying for her mother and father's new house. So you have it's very grey about, is it all bad? The people who've been rurally poor and confronted with the fact that Thailand went from basically a bartering system to an economy engaged in the global economy very quickly, and inflation started occurring, and these people who used to be able to grow enough and barter it with their friends to get by, all of a sudden it's not enough. They need money. And of course, the appetite for consumer goods. So it's not uncommon for that woman who's sacrificing her own precepts, lifts that family from the rural poor to a more of a middle class by educating a brother, university educating a brother, and these kind of things. So it's very complex. Another thing is that prostitution did exist in Thailand even before tourists came. It was always there. And even to this date, the tourists use a small percentage of the prostitutes in Thailand compared to the locals. So it is a part of Thai culture, has been for a millennia. So it's one of those things that's socially accepted. Perhaps because it's socially accepted is one of the reasons it's been able to, with the... But another thing I just have to say is this is normal. The Buddha said all things are of the nature to decay. He said to the monks as he was passing away, who were gathered at his final nirvana, he said, you know, basically practice while you have the chance. Here are the roots of trees, here are the empty spaces. Practice, lest you regret it later. Knowing full well that his sasana was going to degenerate, and he got enlightened in a degenerate age, and that basically conditions will get less and less supportive to practice. So that's, we're talking about the global karma, the group karma of 6 billion human beings. It's probably the case that less and less of the people being born now are coming from human realm and deva realm in terms of where they were in their most recent life. So this affects the overall, and that's what happens. So yeah, it is really helpful, I think, in terms of cosmology, to take that really broad view. At what point are we at in the eon? Not, rather than Thai cultures like this, and it shouldn't be like this, and which we can all do, we just have a look at, Lord Buddha said that this is the way it was going to be. And he said that from here it gets worse. That's the bad news. And that's what I was trying to mirror back to you, is that with the current opportunities and good fortune that you have here, you're really lucky. You have a precious opportunity. As my own concerns for the you know, the next generation in Thailand, many terrible things are happening in Thailand. One is that, and this is also related to economic growth, you know, the good young men who would like to be monks, who have the barami, who have the intelligence, who would be good leaders, very often are not allowed to. That's the one that has to be the advertising executive. That's the one that has to be the bank manager. That's the one that has to go and study in Oxford or Harvard. And now, the one that can become the monk is the one that nobody wanted to marry, or the one that couldn't get a job. So, and this isn't just the monks. This is, and people say, why is the Buddhist sasana degenerating so much? And it's not just the monks are bad, it's that the lay people are not offering up the best. They're offering up the worst. That's not going to work. So now in the Sangha, you have a shortage of leaders, and you have a lot of monks who are not of the best quality. What comes with this is scandals. If the people that became monks were not people with genuine spiritual barami, they didn't really want to do it, they're not there for the right reasons, well then they're the ones that are going to be doing inappropriate things and caught, and their photographs are going to end up in the newspaper. And this is terrible because it's degenerating the overall level of faith of Thai people also. And then they say, the monks are no good. And I've known many young men who, after their 3 months of being a monk, or 1 month of being a monk, mum and dad insisted that they disrobe to go back to work and, you know, pay the bills and keep the consumer goods coming. So it's complex. It's complex. But the point is, unfortunately, you know, I can't see that it's going to turn around and get better. And what it seems to be is that those people who have the merit to be practicing at this point, 2,500 and something years after the Buddha, it's now more like islands. It won't be nation states. So this, the Buddha said, as these years progress, it will degenerate, it'll disintegrate, but we still do have enlightened masters and their teachings. So in the past, you see, if you have a King Asoka, or if you have a, you know, when they brought the religion to Sri Lanka, when the kings embrace it and the kings have power, if those kings themselves are Buddhist practitioners, obviously they have a very important role to play in establishing the institutions and keeping an eye on them and generating them and regenerating and nourishing them. But when the leaders of nations aren't good Buddhist practitioners, then we can't expect that. We have to expect that they'll have their own agendas and their own wrong views. And basically, it's a time for taking responsibility and practicing as much as one can individually, is the sense I have.
Q&A?
Yeah, okay.
We would like to thank Ajahn for the very inspiring and very enlightening Dhamma talk.
Good evening.
Good evening.
You mentioned that your central theme for meditation during this retreat will be Anapanasati Sutta.
Not the sutta, the practice.
The practice.
Yeah.
Will you also expound the sutta, perhaps, during the meditation talk or something?
Yeah, I'll be talking a little bit about the Anapanasati Sutta. I will. Are you coming?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
But I was really hoping that perhaps you could not talk a little bit about it, but talk a lot about it.
Okay, so you got the wrong guy, unfortunately. I'm not a doctor so-and-so PhD monk. I'm a practice monk, and I want to my favorite bit's that first paragraph. After the Buddha sets the scene, where the Buddha basically says, if you do it a lot, you're going to master the four foundations of mindfulness. He's talking about doing it. And then in mastering the four foundations of mindfulness, you'll fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to be doing it. And I'm going to be encouraging people, whatever you're thinking about, let it go. And whatever you're trying to even understand, come back to the felt feeling of the breath, know the present moment as it is. The past is gone, the future is unknown. You might die today. Be here now. It's going to be more my focus. Ajahn Pasano in America, he often says when he gives these Dhamma talks, he just says about thoughts and about feelings. He just reminds people, just see a feeling as a feeling. Just see a thought as a thought. This is a training in the four foundations of mindfulness. Just know a feeling as a feeling without any proliferation. Just objectively know it. It's a feeling. Whether it's pleasant, whether it's the most excruciating feeling you ever had, or the most amazing rapture, you know it as a feeling. Without proliferation around it. And a thought, no matter how profound or profane, is a thought. We just know this is a thought. I'm doing a lot of practice about this.
Any other question? Yes, Yin-chan, yeah.
Ajahn, is there any advantage in practicing meditation in Thailand, in one of the monasteries? Is there an advantage to practicing elsewhere?
I guess you'd have to say which monastery. I've lived in many. Generally, if you picked a good practice monastery, what hopefully you would have there is some quiet and some seclusion. The other obviously really valuable thing about monasteries, if it's a good monastery, is that every single person in the monastery is keeping the precepts strictly all the time. So this does something to what you call the psychosphere, that kind of psychic energy around those walls, is that if everybody, even when they're having conflicts, they're really trying to restrain it and they're really trying to forgive and let go and cultivate metta. If people are really practicing, well then there is something very special in the air. So many people will feel this, and several people have told me when they went to Wat Nanachat a couple of years ago, you walk in those gates and you feel something. So it used to be a place where people dropped the corpses of people who had inauspicious deaths, actually. So it didn't always feel like that. People used to walk in there, it used to feel very creepy. But then you've got 3 decades of monks practicing and people coming and meditating all night on the one prana, the villages, and people coming and making offerings and an enormous amount of kusala activity occurring. But then most importantly, people keeping the precepts. And so people can feel when you walk in the gates, oh, there's a certain quality of coolness. And some people say it's interesting because the insects are really loud, but it's as though you can hear the silence. Even though the insects are very loud, you can hear a quality of silence. So what is that? That's just something that happens in places where people meditate a lot. So this kind of sacred container helps us. I think it does speed up the process of seeing our thoughts more clearly because everyone else is trying to do it. There's probably a synergy thing happening, where more conscious beings are working hard to practice. You can slip into the slipstream. But of course, great monasteries change too.
So if a teacher becomes famous and truckloads of requisites come into the monastery and lots of money comes and then different type of lay people turn up, ones that want to be associated with the famous teacher and ones that want to get some of the money and, you know, different kind of monks come along as well, ones that like the really, all of those nice requisites. And so, you know, monasteries change. I'm not saying it's always the case that if a teacher's famous and there's a lot of requisites that the monks aren't good, but it's sometimes the case that monasteries aren't what they used to be. So you have to be selective. You have to... This is one of the reasons that people wonder. I think there's 50,000 monasteries in Thailand, and I've wondered myself, because now I'm building one. I'm like, why do we build monasteries? And one of the reasons is that they change. Conditions change, places change, and so now at Wat Nanachai, you know, we also have a four-lane highway not very far in front, and you have more and more planes landing over there, and that wasn't the case just 20 years ago. And you have a huge department store going to be built a couple of kilometers down the road, and so it's not the same quiet place. It's still a good place to practice, but the quiet isn't the same. So people go and make new monasteries in new quiet places, and in not long they won't be quiet either, probably. But in general, yes. And also, if there is a monastery with an enlightened being living in it, I must confess, this does have an effect on one's meditation.
Yes, sadhu, sadhu.
It's something in the metta, you know, and all enlightened beings radiate their metta. And so there is something in that. When an Aryapugala enlightened being radiates his metta or her metta in the monastery, this can definitely help the hindrances to drop away a little more quickly. I believe so. For this particular group of people, what I would want to emphasize more, though, is please begin to practice in your daily life every day. Because this is what creates the habit, the upanisai, we say in Pali, this latent habit of being a practitioner. It's what you do on a daily basis that incrementally becomes very powerful. And the other point I was trying to make in the talk, and I'll make it again, was that we can always look at our life and we can say the conditions aren't quite right. It's not quite supportive enough. And then we can look at our internal conditions and we can say, you know, my spiritual faculties, they're weak. I'm not strong enough. I just can't get it. It's not yet time to meditate. I've already heard this a couple of times since I arrived. I'm not ready. So the question is, and it's a very important question, a serious question, is the conditions are probably going to get worse. And if you don't make the effort to develop the powers, the inner faculties, they will weaken further. And so it's like you're saying, you're walking down a mountain and you're saying, well, they keep saying I should walk up, but it's too steep. But the further you walk down the mountain, the further you've got to climb back. So we have to use the conditions that we have, and we have to use the spiritual factors that we have to the degree that we have, and we have to do it sincerely, and we have to do it daily. And in doing that, your spiritual qualities will get deeper, more powerful, and then also the external conditions will, over the long term, improve. It's not necessarily this lifetime, but you end up somewhere where you are supported to practice and where you can practice.
Okay, any more questions?
I thought one thing might be nice is... since the talk was mostly about refuge and the path of practice, I thought maybe if people were interested, we could take refuge together as a nice way to end.